Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Greetings. Thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Fake Mustache Donner, Letty P. No relation to Master P. And joining me today for some death-defying sitting and talking is FlixWise panelist, Miss Kristen Sales.
Hey, everybody.
I've been looking forward to this episode for a really long time. Not only are we covering one of my all-time favorite films, the 59th movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, Buster Keaton's 1924 feature, Sherlock Jr. I'm pausing for applause. But it's also time once again for our annual Turner Classic Film Fest preview show. Woo!
Yay!
Yay! And I'm very, very pleased and happy and delighted to announce that helping us navigate this year's program is a very special guest. Let's welcome to the show TCM Saturday Daytime host, National Board of Review certified Tiffany Vasquez. Welcome to the FlixWise, Tiffany.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So normally we kick things off with the Sight and Sound entry, but because the TCM Film Fest is right around the corner, and also because we're a little pressed for time with Tiffany, so we're going to start with the TCM Film Fest. We're going to talk about TCM's decision to orient the programming around comedies. This year's theme is Make 'em Laugh, which will highlight funny films from cinema's beginnings through the late 80s, even 90s, or aughts. We have Best in Show.
We have Best in Show.
Yeah, everything from Harold Lloyd to the Kentucky Fried Movie. We'll get the TCM treatment. We're going to talk to Tiffany about how the programmers decided what kinds of films to highlight and how to balance between the lesser-known works and the fan favorites. And, of course, then we'll get around to Buster. All right, guys, you ready? Focused. Let's do it. Let's roll them.
All right. Here we go. Quiet.
Quiet. Quiet.
Roll them.
Okay, so the TCM Film Festival is upon us. It's this week, April 6th through April 9th. And scores of classic film fans will descend upon Hollywood Boulevard's grand movie palaces for a four-day celebration of the great cinematic delights of yesteryear. Both of my guests today are seasoned veterans of the fest, and we're here to offer a preview of what potential attendees can expect. So, Tiffany, I'm going to start with you. Can you set the scene for us? What is the TCM Film Fest, and why should people come out?
Well, it started in 2010. That was the first one, and it's basically a gathering of all TCM fans. I mean, as you know, and as any fan of TCM knows, the TCM fan base is quite unlike any other channel's fan base. We are pretty close-knit, and social media keeps us together, keeps us watching films together. It's an incredible thing, and there's needs to be a further connection beyond e-connection, so we get to watch movies together and these classic Hollywood movie palaces and theaters that are just renowned, and just even being in the Roosevelt Hotel, which has so much Hollywood history. And we get to just enjoy each other's company and talk about films, see people in person that we may not ever again have the chance of seeing. You know, past guests have been Maureen O'Hara, Ernest Borgnine, and sadly and obviously won't always and have not always been able to be in their presence again. So it's quite a unique experience, and you get to experience everything from silent films to more modern, but definitely in the conversation of classic films, incredible guests, and just having each other as fans getting together and watching all these great movies.
Yeah, I've only ever been once, but Sales, I know you've been seven times.
Well, this is going to be my seventh.
This is your seventh
festival.
Time.
Yeah, I've been to every year except for the first one.
Yeah.
So I don't recall there being like a theme. I mean, I know there was a musical theme in years past, but I feel like comedy is really a kind of a different direction for the festival. So I was wondering, Tiffany, like, why did the programmers decide to make comedy the theme this year? Like, what's unique about that?
They do have a theme almost every year, if I'm not mistaken. Like you said, music was one of them. history in Hollywood was another, 1 year, style, travel. So there have certainly been themes, but again, you can sort of make a lot of movies fit into that theme. And at some point, of course, comedy's going to be touched upon. And honestly, there are a lot of reasons why we just need to laugh this year. We just need to come together and enjoy comedy and remember happy times. And I mean, it sounds, I'm a little bit of a downer right now, but we really need this. And there's such an importance in comedic therapy, especially in film, and there's such a expansive way of looking at it. So it's great to have it be the theme this year. There are obviously so many movies we are touching upon and can even further expand the conversation on. So it's great that it's this year. I think it fits pretty well.
Yeah, you're reading my mind. I know. I mean, I'm always happy to watch whatever TCM wants to program, but and honestly, I was like a little bit skeptical initially, like comedy, huh? But then looking over the program, I just realized like this is exactly what I need right now.
Yeah.
And I'm speaking of even my own reaction to comedy, I think is pretty telling because I have a tendency to think like the big dramas are the more significant works, right? I do think there's this perception within like the people who are very, very interested in films to kind of disregard comedy. And I was wondering if you could talk about how we can restore or kind of bolster comedy's reputation as important, because I think it absolutely is.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny how so many classic comedies, I mean, Sherlock Jr. being one of them, will then be revived and be reinserted into the conversation and it held a place like number 59 on this Sight and Sound poll. But yet, modern comedies are enjoyed, but they'll never enter into the conversation, very seldom when it comes to award season or anything like that. And so it is interesting how we sort of think of comedy as something we can enjoy, but then not reflect upon. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure why we do that. I think that the way to remedy that would then to constantly would be to look at it further and sort of take apart these comedies and see what they're really doing. Because, and then there's also to contradict myself, there's also just the argument that modern comedies are just not nearly as brilliant as classic comedies are. So there's one thing, there's one way you could look at that.
For sure, yeah. And I think that TCM offering this showcase for comedy will go a long way in helping to shine a light on the sort of enduring power of comedy. Like,
and the variety of programming, I think, really like brings an added depth to a genre which is so wide-ranging and which can appeal to almost every sensibility. Like the types of comedy on display in the programming are incredibly varied, and you have everything from you know, movies from the 20s to movies from the turn of the century, from 2000. And you have slapstick comedies, and you have satires, and you have broad comedies, and you have Marx Brothers, and you have romantic comedies. And it's kind of crazy when you put everything together like this, you see, oh, actually, like, just in the programming itself, you're, like, making a case for the fact that comedies are, like, integral to our movie experiences, and they're just as legitimate as, you know, something, a heavy Douglas Sirk melodrama.
Yeah. Which, by the way, you also have this year.
Yeah.
So a little bit of everything. Yeah. So do you know how the programmers go about deciding, first of all, what the theme is going to be and what specific films they're going to show?
I actually do not. Okay. They are magicians in their own right. And they're incredible. The TCM programming team is just absolutely incredible. And I can't imagine what it must be like to put all of this together. And so I don't know the very beginning stages. I'm much more involved in the way later stages.
Okay. Where does your role come in?
I come in at the very end.
Okay.
And it's time for me to, the fun part, it's time for me to enjoy these movies with the fans. So
right.
I get to introduce a few things and or get to talk with the fans. Last year, I was a roving reporter, and I got to spend a lot of time just talking with fans about what movies they really wanted to go to. Because if anyone's gone to the TCM Film Festival, you know that creating your own schedule is one of the hardest things you can possibly do. So there's a ton of Sophie's Choices. And I love talking to fans on how you make, what decision you make on deciding how to spend your time during the weekend.
Right.
Yeah, and that's one of my favorite things, too, to talk about with other people is how they made their decisions, how they shaped their weekend. So let's talk about this year. What are you actually doing at the festival this year? Are you introducing movies? Are you talking to fans? And what you're looking forward to?
I'm doing a combination of all of those. I will. One thing I'm very excited about is I will be introducing The Egg and I, and I'm going to be talking with Kate McMurray, of course, daughter of Fred McMurray, for that. And I just love Claudette Colbert. I think she was outstanding in every way. It Happened One Night is really the movie that turned me into a classic film fan. It started everything. Mm-hmm. And speaking of comedy and classic film, that movie impressed me so much because I'm actually more impressed when I'm able to laugh at a film from, say, 1934 than cry at it. I feel like things that are dramatic in the human experience don't really change, in my opinion, but comedy sure does. And when I can still laugh at something from 1934, I'm doubly impressed. And that really gets me. So I'm really excited about that. There's also Jezebel is playing.
Yeah.
A real, real riot.
Oh, yeah.
And I get to introduce that with a TCM Backlot winner, who I'm not sure who that is yet, but whoever wins a TCM Backlot, by the way, is TCM's fan base, fan club. And who wins that, I will co-introduce the movie with, so that's going to be exciting,
yeah,
especially
cool.
Because I have won a TCM fan contest before, and I know how incredible that feels, and it is, so that's going to be great. And then other stuff, too.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about ways that TCM tries to foster a community of classic film fans? And I know some of these other contests and just other outreach programs, it's not like it's like an after-school program, but...
No, but like the online stuff, like the TCM website and, you know, or like coupling with Fanstruck, like just doing a lot of like fan outreach stuff to like foster communities online, and then like hosting IRL events like the festival or like the movie locations tour. Like there's so much going on. Like how does that all sort of like funnel into the festival in terms of fandom?
Well, everything's so well connected, and obviously TCM is pretty much the only network I can say. I was actually talking to a TCM staff member the other day, and we were like, can you even come up with another example of another network that has this kind of fan base? And he was saying, well, maybe in the 80s MTV and in the 90s MTV. And I can sort of agree with that, but even still, there's nothing like this. There's no other thing where we have these multiple opportunities connect. And with that, I also have to give a huge shout out to TCM's social team, because they are just amazing at constantly reaching out to fans, creating all these hashtags. I mean, for the month of March, there was a tournament of all like villains in movies, and so they had March Malice as the hashtag, and people were tweeting about all the movies that they were seeing on that, whether there was a Psycho or King Kong, and things like that, which show you how much TCM actually thinks of its fans. And so many fans have guest programmed before on the network. So many fans through Backlot have visited the set, have you know, met with Ben. I'm also going to do, I think, a few backlot events during the festival, and it's such an active effort to continually involve the fans in the process. Fan opinions are so important in programming, and it's really an amazing thing because they don't have to do that, but it also shows how important it is to them and how much it means to keeping the network.
And having been to so many festivals, it's really like interesting to see how much the engagement has really ramped up in terms of at the festival itself. Like, there's so many like sort of adjunct events to go to or fan meetups and stuff now that you could almost do a whole weekend schedule of just TCM fan stuff or the talks or the talking to the programmers and stuff, like just besides the movies. Like, there's so much, there's such a rich community going on at the festival itself that a lot of times that becomes like the lure to go as much as wanting to see, you know, a certain movie. It's really kind of amazing. Yeah.
That's completely true. I mean, that's also another reason to just keep going to the TCM Film Festival, because one year you can go and maybe just watch only movies, and then another year you can go and just only go to the talks or the interviews. Another year you can go and, like you said, just strictly do fan meetups.
Yeah.
I know even they start getting together days before the festival even starts. A lot of fans get to LA early. And I know that they do like a TCM specific Hollywood Forever Cemetery tour, where mm-hmm. they'll go around to graves and sites that, you know, like no one else ever cares about usually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like, oh my God,
yeah. Yeah.
And so it's really incredible. It's such a great thing. And also just being in person with people who you usually only rarely get to talk to online, and you know, you're seeing their words, you're not seeing their face, and you're not hearing their voice. It does make a difference to be with them and to actually see these movies with them in person. I remember last year I was able to pop into Desk Set for a little bit, and I was able, and then you walk in the room and you see so many faces that you tweet at all the time. You're like, hey, yeah, funny.
Yeah, you can put a face to the handle.
It's the best. And then watching the movie together, it was just the most riotous experience. It was so much fun. I walked out of that movie like, I think that's the most fun I've had in a theater so far.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. And I think that's why comedy is so important, because it's such a cathartic experience to share with other people, which I feel like is why it's the perfect festival theme. Like, just thinking back in the past like 7 years that I've been to, some of the best times I've ever had was just like laughing my head off with other people at like last year, the Midnight Show of Roar, which is not a comedy, but that movie's pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
And or GOG, the robot movie. And it's just like watching a Marx Brothers movie or watching History of the World Part 1 on a Saturday afternoon and sitting way in the back away from everybody and just laughing your head off. I just feel like this year there's so many opportunities to just have a good time with your friends that it's kind of a unique, it's more than a film festival, because it's not even, you know, the films are not almost the main part. It's about spending time with these people that you enjoy.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think we're a little short on time right now. So I just want to really quickly, the number one movie that you think people must go check out, or at least the one you're most looking forward to. Tiffany, do you have one?
I don't have one specific, but I will just say Nitrate.
Yeah,
that's you know, it's not every day that you are able to see a film projected on Nitrate, that's for sure. And there are going to be four movies projected: Black Narcissus, Lady in the Dark, Laura, the 1934, The Man Who Knew Too Much. So I would say that's what I'm personally, I don't know if I'm going to be able to see a full movie, but I'm going to see at least a few minutes of one of those. I have to.
Yes. Make a point of it.
Yeah, all I right. agree. That's my number one, too.
Yeah. Black Narcissus.
Yeah.
I think Black Narcissus is way up there for me, but I have to say I feel like postcards is going to be very cathartic for me. I think I need that. And I need to be around people who will appreciate that. But otherwise, I'm going to go with Black Narcissus. Everyone go check that out. And if you are there, come say hi to us. All right. Well, Tiffany, I'm going to let you go.
Okay.
But thank you so much for coming on, giving us your time. And hopefully we'll see you at the fest.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I'll see you there. I hope everyone's going, has an amazing time, and so glad to be on this podcast.
All right. Awesome.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you again, Tiffany. Now it's time for our Sight and Sound entry. Today we have an experiment in self-reflexive meta-commentary, a film which blurs the line between artifice and reality and explores the ways that we as viewers engage with this medium we call cinema. No, it is an Abbas Kiarostami or yet another Jean-Luc Godard pontification, but rather good old Buster Keaton's 1924 feature, Sherlock Jr. Is it too early for that kind of shade?
What, on Kiarostami?
Or Godard.
Godard, no.
It's never too early.
People have been shading Godard since like 1966. I feel like we're in good company.
Okay,
there.
Good. All right. So Buster didn't have the lofty theoretical ambitions of someone like Godard, I don't think. But I think his primary goal was always to make us laugh and wow us with his jaw-dropping stunt work. Sherlock Jr., in case you haven't seen it. I mean, what are you doing? It's like 50 minutes.
First
Go
of
check
all,
it out.
Turn off this podcast.
Yeah. Come
it's,
on now.
It's 40 minutes.
Yeah. yeah, there is nothing you're doing that's more important. Go watch Sherlock
there
Jr.
There are episodes of Iron Fist that are longer than Sherlock Jr.
Wow.
So I'm assuming. I actually don't know. I'm going to put it out there that Iron Fist is longer than 40 minutes.
Yeah.
So stop wasting your lives, mm-hmm. people, and just watch Sherlock Jr. like 3 times in a row.
Exactly. Well, in case you need a refresher, this is basically what happens. Sherlock Jr. tells the story of a penniless movie projectionist, played by Buster Keaton, who has aspirations of becoming a detective. Through the course of the film, this lowly projectionist somehow finds himself falsely accused of stealing a pocket watch belonging to the father of his lady love. Of course, the audience knows that our upstanding hero would never do such a thing, and the thief is, in fact, a rival suitor who duped the girl and her father into believing poor Buster committed the crime. Angry and dejected over losing his girl, Buster returns to his day job as a movie projectionist and imagines himself as a Sherlock Holmes-style investigator inside the world of a movie he's projecting. From there, Buster takes us into a film within a film where hijinks and hilarity ensue. As I mentioned in the intro, Sherlock Jr. is the 59th movie on the International Critics Poll. It's a sighting of the rarest of rare birds. A critical darling. That's an actual comedy. Remarkable, I know. Like really funny. Ha-ha funny. Not like rules of the game funny. Sorry.
I guess just all French masters piss off.
Boom.
We're taking
knocking them down.
Taking you down a peg. Renoir, you better watch it.
I know that I speak only for myself. I didn't mean to like guilt you by association,
okay.
Yeah. that said, it's so much more than just an amusing trifle. It's funny. It's moving, poignant, sophisticated. In short, it's perfect. At least that's my opinion. Sales. What do you think, Sherlock Jr.? Perfect.
It is a perfect movie.
Yeah.
And I say that with no reservations, no strings attached, and other movie titles that start with no. it's a totally pure concept. The concept is pure, the execution is flawless. It's trimmed of any fat. It's entirely crystalline in terms of just like cinema. Its ideas are profound, but to the point and stated in such a way that, like, I don't want to get too highfalutin, but it's like pure truth. You know, when you just like hear, you just read something and you're like, oh yeah, that's true. Like that's this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like a really long run on sentence. It's just a short and to the point sentence. It's like that Ernest Hemingway thing, like write one true sentence. Like Sherlock Jr. is the one true sentence of American cinema. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's stupid. There's like almost nothing to talk about because Sherlock Jr. is just so self-evidently the best movie.
Yeah.
But let's talk about it anyway.
Yeah. I mean, we don't really have a choice at this point.
Yeah.
I went to the trouble of introducing it, so we might as well talk about it.
Right, which is so funny. Like, why would you ever talk about the plot of a Buster Keaton movie? And it's Boy Meets Girl.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. It's like, this movie is almost too good for a plot synopsis.
Mm-hmm.
The plot synopsis is so archetypical because so many of his films are just working with archetypes anyway.
Yeah.
That it's like, it's everything you think. And then the movie is astonishing because it's in the details and in the execution and in the rhythms and in the framing. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's cinema. Mm-hmm. I mean, the less exciting the plot synopsis is, that either means the movie is a masterpiece or it's the most boring thing you've ever seen.
True.
This is the former.
Yeah. Yeah, I can... Generally, the shorter my synopsis, the better the movie.
Yes.
I've found.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt really silly writing... this out like there's a thing with the pocket watch. Who cares?
Yeah, of course.
But I will say that the movie within the movie is ingenious,
right?
And I don't know that I'd seen that prior to this film. Do you know if that is something that had been used before?
I know that in at least one interview and probably other interviews, when Keaton was asked about it, he said basically that. The concept of rear projection or back projection, as he calls it in this one interview, didn't exist in and of itself, like as a term. And I'm not enough of a film scholar to know if there were any other films prior to this that used that technique of what we would call rear projection. But in this one interview that I think he did in the early 60s, late 50s, he says basically that, because the interviewer says, how did you do that? Was it back projection? He says, yes, it's back projection, but that term didn't exist at the time. The only reason, and then he goes on to say that the only reason that he made the film was to get that sequence in, because he wanted to do that sequence, so he built everything around it, which is very typical of the way that he made his films. It was basically you would come up, or he or his gag writers would come up with a concept that they wanted to execute, and then they would build out from that. So they'd build an introduction and then they build an ending around whatever was that centerpiece. And so I think it's remarkable that because everything in this film, because it's so short, works so eloquently. And even the beginning is very fleet and there are some good gags in it. So it's less conspicuous that the film within a film sequence is kind of the reason to make the film, mm-hmm. because everything works really well. But of course it is the reason, because it's the standout mm-hmm. sequence, which is a roundabout way to say that there's nothing in his work prior to this that gave indication that this sequence would be coming. Because there are certain gags that he worked out in his shorts with Fatty Arbuckle and in his own shorts before making features that reoccur in his features. So you can see him sort of testing them out or doing test runs. But this sort of rear projection thing is not really one of them.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem as if it's been practiced.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of the reason why this film is so beloved by cinephiles is because it's about movies.
Yes.
And I just think that most of the early, most at least American silent films that I've seen are not as self-aware. There is that meta element.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the only other silent films I can think of where they really do call attention to the medium are like Ziga Vertov, like Man with a Movie Camera.
Mm-hmm.
But it started a very, very popular trend. Like,
right.
Cinema is a very important, a very significant topic.
I mean, I feel like in Keaton's own work, there's always a preoccupation with, I don't want to say, like, metatextuality, because that's too the problem with talking about Keaton in terms of intellectualism is because he never approached it from that perspective.
Right. Yeah, you feel really silly. Yeah,
yeah, you feel. I mean, it's fraudulent in a certain way. And when he was being rediscovered critically by all these like very intellectual French critics, they would ask him all these kinds of questions, and he would just be like, "No, we just did it." you know, which I think some of that is legitimate modesty, and I think some of it was false modesty, because obviously he knew how good he was.
Yeah.
But I think his essential approach was more workmanlike, and it really came from a certain sense of engineering. For example, in the sequence where he's the film within a film sequence where he is hopping from, let's say, like a mountain to a beach, the background is changing behind him. The way that they did that was they would just shoot whatever in the ocean or in the mountains, and then they would stop right before he leaps, and then they would just measure where he was. And he said in interviews that they just used surveyor's tools to get precise measurements of where they were, and they measured it from two different camera angles so that when they set up the cameras in the next location, whether it was the snow or the mountains or whatever, they would just replicate that with the surveyor's tool. So it is really a sense of bringing in sort of industrial practices or workman-like practices to artistic ends,
mm-hmm.
Which is why Keaton's gags and his physical comedy, in my opinion, hold up so well, is because it's not coming from a sense of theatricality as in the theater. It's coming from a sense of like architecture and engineering and things that are mathematical and eternal. Like they're not tied into trends, like you know, there's
like I shouldn't encourage this sort of behavior.
Anyway. No. We can't go into...
yeah.
We're not going to go into verses right away.
Yeah.
We can get there. We can keep it Keaton.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah. And so there is that sense of... He wants to play with images, and he did it. There's a short of his called The Playhouse, which uses... multiple exposures. He's like the keeper of this vaudeville house or something. He's cleaning it, or he works there or something. And then when it's empty, he imagines himself playing all of the roles. So he's every musician in the band. He's every minstrel dancer. He's every member of the audience, and there are elements of that which you see in Sherlock Jr., but that playfulness and that use of really precise in-camera optics is on display there, and that short is like from 1920 or 1921, so that's a good amount of time before this one. But I feel like you're right that the reason that this movie is so heralded and so beloved is that it almost feeds the sort of sense of self-importance that cinephiles have about their cinephilia, which is a little unfortunate, but it doesn't take away from the fact that it's an incredible movie.
Sure.
And no one has done what he's trying to do in this movie better, and it's been like 90 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
More than 90 years.
Yeah. I mean, this is like the simplest, purest way of talking about about the appeal of cinema.
Right.
Right?
Like, no, you show, I mean, you don't have to talk about it. You just show somebody Sherlock Jr. And it doesn't matter how old they are or how young they are, because there's enough, it's visually enthralling enough that you can turn your brain off and just like someone, like a little kid watching a magic trick. So it can appeal to you if you're very young. And then it appeals to you if you're a little bit older, because you wonder how that stuff got made, how that actually worked. You start to think, holy, what? Like, I've never even seen that. How did they do that?
Mm-hmm.
And then you sort of get into it, and then you get a little older and you start to notice the framing techniques in the filmmaking, the cutting, the mirroring of certain images, the repetition of certain gags that follow certain comedy rules, and you start to sort of marvel at the elegance of its construction. So I feel like every time you watch this at a different point in your life, you can notice different facets of it. And the incredible thing is that they all hold up. Like, this is the most well-constructed building of a movie. Like, this movie, you know, will stand forever. Mm-hmm. Just like a great building will stand forever. Mm-hmm. It's flawless. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you talked about how this movie is built around the central idea of the movie within the movie. But, and that's true of most of his works, right? Like, they're built around, you always get the sense, like, he imagines the stunt or the gag and then builds the story around it.
Yeah, that's how his comedy writers did it.
Yeah.
Is they came up with whatever the central idea was, and then they constructed a story. So if the central idea is in the middle of the movie, they would come up with something, the first part that would lead up to it, and then they would come up with an ending. Or sometimes they would think of the ending first, and then they'd have to work backwards from there.
Yeah.
I mean, there was never, like, a script per se.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there's no real interest in character in a Buster Keaton film. It's not where he's coming from.
Yeah.
So everything is constructed around the gag or the device or the set piece or the whatever he's doing visually with the camera, in terms of optics or in terms of display, and then everything else is built around that.
Yeah, I think the exception in my mind is probably The General,
mm-hmm.
but that was based on a pre-existing story.
You're right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like of the 10 or so or 11 films that he made independently in the 20s. The General is probably the one that's most story-oriented. But even then, because it is an adaptation of a nonfiction book, and so there is a certain narrative that it has to adhere to in a certain way, it is constructed... I like to think of The General as a train. You know, the movie is a train itself. It's always going forward. The motion is propulsive, and there's a begin point and an end point. So it's not like a car where you can drive around whatever. You're on a track and you have to go. So the filmmaking itself takes the shape of and the tenor of locomotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just the way that Keaton's brain worked. Like, he had a mechanical mindset in a certain way. Most of his films sort of feel as if they're being made by someone who is not a machine himself, but has a sort of an affection for mechanization,
mm-hmm.
for movement, for pieces fitting together. It's not that they're non-narrative or that the characters are weak per se. It's just that's not where the emphasis is coming from, unlike many of his contemporaries.
Right, which we will, I promise, talk about. But yeah, you're right. In this sense, it's not the mechanization of a train necessarily, but rather a movie projector, right? That's,
yeah,
again,
in this yeah. film. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you remember the first time you saw it?
No.
No.
I don't.
Yeah.
I think it was probably, like, on DVD. Like, I didn't get into Keaton, like, I didn't see it when I was a kid. Like, it wasn't a movie that I grew up on. I got into Keaton, I think, like... I remember I watched it in college, in a college class. But I feel like that was not the first time I had seen it. I think I'd maybe seen it in high school.
Yeah.
First. And I don't think I fully got it or it appealed to me. Because for a long time I had other Buster Keaton films that I would say that were my favorite or would say that was the best, so I had other answers to those questions. But now it seems sort of patently obvious that this is the masterwork on top of masterworks. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a guy who made 10 more or less perfect movies in 5 years, which is, in and of itself is insane,
mm-hmm.
This is head and shoulders. And it's the one that really stands up in terms of critique from all angles. So there's so many different ways of looking at this movie in terms of cinema, in terms of Keaton's own performance, in terms of direction, in terms of even in terms of narrative, because he's doing something. It's a pretty cheeky movie in terms of references to other things. I mean, you have the Sherlock Holmes references, you have the sort of critique of popular culture with, like, the chic and the kind of almost like a spy or melodrama types of movies that were very popular at the time. And I like all of that stuff sort of falls away, I think, in terms of a contemporary thinking of the movie, because we're so far away from that. But for a modern audience, like, that might be the aspect that they would be glomming onto, as opposed to the more surrealist aspects that a lot of, like, European intellectuals really got into,
right,
when they saw this movie. And that's sort of carried the discourse for many decades now.
Sure, yeah. I mean, Keaton might have been underplaying his own kind of cinephilia and attachment to the form, because, like, clearly he's a fan, mm-hmm, of movies. He, mm-hmm, made a movie about movies.
Right.
And so he made, like, Three Ages is apparently a parody of
Intolerance.
Of Intolerance.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, so, like, he may not have had the sort of mindset of, like, this is an intellectual discourse that I'm having with this medium, mm-hmm, but it is certainly aware, yeah, of contemporary film.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Three Ages is a good example of that, because he is making fun of Intolerance. And then in the short that I mentioned, Playhouse, there's a really good gag in it, which when the audience members are watching the vaudeville show, and the audience members are all played by Buster Keaton in various wigs, playing various men and women and old people and babies and etc. There's a gag where one of the audience members looks at the program for the play, and it's like all of the credits are Buster Keaton. So it's like a Buster Keaton production, Buster Keaton in a Buster Keaton whatever, and it's just like, and all of the roles say Buster Keaton. So there's like 20 lines of that, and that's a Thomas Ince gag, because when Thomas Ince made movies, all of the credits were like a Thomas Ince production, Thomas Ince presents, written and directed by Thomas Ince. So there's a lot of like you know, he knew what's up, and he was, I think, what gave Keaton the impetus and the sort of the leeway to make fun of Hollywood establishment and contemporary film culture is because he didn't come from film culture.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't make a movie until he was like 20 or something.
20? Oh, 20.
Well, because he was in vaudeville since he was a baby.
Right.
And I mean, he actually, I think he was a little older, maybe 22. And then he didn't even know like how movies worked or anything. And then he met Fatty Arbuckle, and Fatty Arbuckle was like, "Come and make this." And when Keaton got on set, or there's this like famous story of when he first met them, he immediately like just went over to the movie camera, like whatever movie camera they had on set, and started taking it apart to see how the parts worked. And so, because he wanted to know like physically in the material world, like how that actually worked, which I think is really indicative of his interest in cinema. So he kind of has this outsider view of movies, because he's not like you know, a United Artists guy. Like, he's not like a Mary Pickford person. He wasn't there at the beginning, really. Mm-hmm. Like, he's coming in from the vaudeville world, and it doesn't have the innate familiarity with film form. And so I think that kind of allows him to be very playful and not adhere to like the rules of what a movie is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Reminds me of another outsider director, actor turned director, performer turned director, which I think brings me to a really important point. Not only is Buster Keaton, like, one of the best filmmakers of all time, he's also probably the hottest. I feel like this bears mentioning. And I think Orson Welles is in the running.
Right. We were trying to determine what the best film was made by the hottest person.
Mm-hmm. And, like, as far as overlap between, like, on the scale, he's, like, he's certainly a 10 on the hotness, and a 10... He's a 10 in both. I don't think there's another director
Keaton
in the world.
Keaton and Sherlock Jr.?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. But I feel like you're right that the only contention, and not coincidentally, another figure who came from the stage and not cinema, Orson Welles, also a total babe, also made Citizen Kane, which is a 10 movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like, I feel like maybe readers should like send in their choice.
Yes.
Do you
Let
think
us know.
That Buster Keaton is the hottest person to make the best movie, which is Sherlock Jr., or do you think that that Orson Welles was the hottest person to make the best movie, that being Citizen Kane?
Mm-hmm. Or if there are other contenders, let us know.
I mean, I don't think there are other contenders, but feel free to give us your picks.
Yeah, I mean, nothing against Alfred Hitchcock, but, like, he wasn't easiest on the eyes.
No. Oh, love him. Leave poor Alfie out of this.
Listen, he's okay. But I'm certainly open to that argument. Mm-hmm. If you feel like Alfred Hitchcock is a total stud, then right, I want to hear from you.
That's a different episode entirely,
yeah.
I feel like.
I just feel like we have to get that out of the way.
We do. Yeah.
And that's not to say, and that brings me to what we've been sort of dancing around this whole time, is that Keaton is often compared, not necessarily favorably or unfavorably, just he often is compared to his two other main contemporaries, Charlie Chaplin and Harold Lloyd. And I just want to talk about what kind of each of their strengths are, because I think I'm right in saying, like, for us, Keaton is the best. Like, he's our favorite.
Yeah, for me, definitely. There's no qualifying statement. Yeah.
But I do feel like we should resist the urge to pit them against each other, because I do think they all have their individual strengths.
Yeah, I think what is illuminating to talk about in relation to the big three at the time is that all of their, they were all working at relatively the same time, came out of relatively similar backgrounds and circumstances in terms of performance style, had sort of unparalleled control over their own work during the peaks of their work, and all of their works have stood the test of time and become codified as classics, whereas a lot of other people making similar films at the time have not really survived that. And I think definitely, you know, it's illuminating, but it's also a little bit limiting to say that they're all sort of primarily one thing. But if you can go with the thesis of Buster Keaton being kind of the mechanically minded, very contemporary in terms of 20th century mechanization and industry and that kind of thing, then I think that you are more easily swayed by the thesis that Chaplin is more of a 19th century artist and has a lot of kinship with sort of Victorian melodrama and is more tied to the old world in a way that Keaton is quintessentially an American and an early 20th century American artist. And then I think also Keaton is not interested in lessons. He's not interested in morals. He's not interested in swaying you with emotion, which is not to say that his films can't be emotional, but obviously Chaplin is. And as an artist, Chaplin is concerned with uplift in a certain way and with politics and with social issues. And that informs the stories and the types of storytelling that he does. And then Harold Lloyd is interested in character. Harold Lloyd, like, invented the romantic comedy. And I think that that's why his films really play to an audience, because he's working in a form that is still totally popular and familiar nowadays. Mm-hmm. And then also his set pieces were extraordinary. And Harold Lloyd was always really more interested in getting a laugh, and I don't mean that in a cheap way, and like he you know, doing degrading himself, but I mean there is a lot of I feel like underlining almost everything. Even sometimes Keaton would sacrifice precision for humor, you know. A lot of that is more you're looking at something and it's extraordinary, but for Harold Lloyd there's always that underlying idea of like, where are the laughs in the picture? Like, he was always more of a showman and like an everyman, and his films are always really character based, and so he's playing like types, you know. He's playing like a country boy, or he's playing like a an urban go-getter, or he's playing, you know, a jerky rich guy, and he actually has storylines, and Harold Lloyd very importantly has, like, romances. He's kind of a sexy leading man in a way that Keaton and Chaplin aren't. Mm-hmm. You know, Keaton may be very good looking, but the romance aspect of his movies are nil. I mean, there's really, it's not there.
Yeah, it's an afterthought.
Yeah.
You talk about performance styles, and I wanted to talk about Buster as performer, because I think when we talk about Buster Keaton, we talk about the precision and, like, his physicality, which we're also going to have to touch on. But in terms of, like, the more subtle physicality as opposed to the big, obviously, mm-hmm. he's willing to break his neck literally for a good gag.
Right.
But I think there's also a subtlety in what he's doing.
Absolutely. I think, and I'm going to say it, I already said he was an underrated director, but I think he's an underrated actor mm-hmm. too. Especially, I would encourage people to seek out the first feature he did, The Saphead from 1920, which he did before he started making his shorts. It's like, I think it's between when he ended his collaboration with Fatty Arbuckle and he just was hired as an actor. Like, it's not a film that is his per se. It's a adaptation of a stage play that Douglas Fairbanks originated the role of. And if you watch this movie, the movie is, like, okay. But watch him, and his performance is so subtle and so funny and so good. I think Keaton does more with his eyes, like just the flick of an eye, like under an eyebrow, than anyone in movie history. And I think specifically the last scene in Sherlock Jr., where it's just the shot reverse shot of his face, and he's watching the screen and imitating what goes on the screen. And just that sequence of gags is just him, his face, and the tiniest little physical movements of his body, trying to place his hand. And he has this way of conveying an alienation from his body, which only works when you are extraordinarily skilled, physically.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, only someone who has a supernatural control over their physical movements can convincingly convey someone who is totally detached from their body and who doesn't know what's going on and who can convey a kind of awkwardness and a kind of innocence that he does at the end of Sherlock Jr.
Mm-hmm.
It's
So he's known as the Great Stone Face, which we haven't actually mentioned yet.
No.
It seems like it goes without saying.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, that's a famous nickname people know about.
Yeah. But again, you can do so, he does so much with so little, right? The movements, the face doesn't move very much.
No, but that's why it's so impactful.
Right.
When it does. And because he's not constantly mugging for the camera. I mean, there is an implacability there, but it's not, you know, it's not totally. I mean, that was always a falsehood, the Great Stone Face. It's just a nickname that stuck. But I feel like, you know, I like that he doesn't move, he doesn't react facially as much to convey the fact that you can tell that he's thinking, so that you can actually see what he's thinking on his face and in his movements.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a certain kind of commitment to intelligence in mm-hmm. his performance style.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary considering he came from the world of, like, vaudeville, which a lot of vaudeville acts are very broad because you're really playing to the back of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting too because you watch, like, some of his earlier films with Arbuckle, and Keaton really mugs it up in some of those and is very broad and has not honed the kind of persona that he later became so renowned for.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was really a commitment on his part to say, I'm going to commit to being a certain kind of personality on screen, and I'm going to tailor my performances to this performance style, and I'm going to look for or manufacture stories that can highlight this performance mm-hmm. style. So it's really as affected as, you know, Chaplin's Hatton Bowler and Kane or Harold Lloyd's glasses. Mm-hmm. Like, it really was a decision. I think it just plays... It's just aged so well now that, I mean, subtlety is sort of caught up to him in terms of acting. It just seems modern and unaffected.
Yeah.
But it's just as much a character as anything.
Yeah.
I guess my question is, we're saying that this is his best movie, right? What makes this better than, let's say, the Buster Keaton movie, which is higher on the Sight and Sound list, the general?
Yeah.
What makes it better? Because this is a question that I don't know if I necessarily have an answer for.
Right. I think this one's funnier.
Okay. I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I think that's
true. I don't know if that counts for anything, which I think it does.
Yeah.
He's a comedic filmmaker.
Sure.
And so I think his funniest,
mm-hmm.
and his funniest and his most perfect.
Yeah.
It's most succinct.
Yeah. That's key.
Yeah.
Because I think The General is as perfect a movie as this one, but it's not as succinct.
Mm-hmm.
And there is more attempt to towards realism, realistic photography, world building, character. I mean, it's a movie with big movie ambitions. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that I just prefer about Sherlock Jr. is that it is uninterested in such a worldly, you know, who wants to get bogged down in details?
Yeah. Especially when your world is the Confederate South.
Leaving that aside. Yeah, and I just feel like this is... it's a very simple concept, and it just goes from piece to piece to piece to piece. And it has the best of his short work, which is the succinctness and the pacing and the multiplicity of gags and how they build upon each other. And it sustains it for basically all of its 40-minute runtime, which makes it better than any of the shorts he did, which topped out at 20 minutes. And it makes it, I think, possibly better than any other sustained run of gags in any of his other features, because I don't know if there's a 40-minute sequence that can stand up to this movie as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's probably why it's better, but The General still is... It's perfect. They're both solid.
I guess I prefer Sherlock Jr. just because in my own experience in watching it, I immediately understood the appeal of the film. And it was, you know how sometimes you have those experiences where you watch something and you're like, that's me. I just immediately understood it.
Yeah. No, and that word immediately is the key, because it's an immediate movie.
Yeah.
There's no pretense towards setting anything up. It just goes straight to the heart of movement and rhythm and pacing and framing and just kind of the meat of what makes a movie a movie. Mm-hmm. What is cinema?
Yeah.
It's sort of stripped bare of any of the other things that, you know, this movie sort of makes ancillary.
Yeah. Just before we sign out.
Yeah.
I think, one, we have to answer the question, worthy of the 59th spot. Frankly, I think there's a case we made this could be the number one film of all time.
Yeah, I don't think it's worthy of the 59th. I would put it at least in the top 40.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's terrific. Like, I think there's a case we made. 1924, we should have quit while we were ahead, you know?
I mean, we still had a lot of movies to make. We sure did,
yeah. I don't think we may have equaled Sherlock, but I don't know that we've topped it. Mm. I think when I talk to people about silent cinema and just older cinema in general, you talk to people on the street who aren't cinephiles, and they often have not seen a Buster Keaton movie.
Yeah.
And I just hope we can right now make a case for why this still matters.
Oh, well, if you're going to watch one Buster Keaton movie or one silent movie, it's got to be Sherlock Jr.
Yeah.
First of all, again, the runtime.
Yeah.
Just literally take 40 minutes out of your day.
Yeah.
And second, it's just thrilling.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's just immediately appealing because it's so visceral.
Yeah.
There's nothing to think about. There's nothing to adjust to in terms of in the way that sometimes you have to adjust to silent movies because the way that they're made is unfamiliar to you.
Yeah.
There's no barrier between the audience and the film.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that adjustment, while it's not, you don't have to do as much adjusting here, but there is some. But I think it is worth it to make that adjustment because you do get so much out of it. And I've heard people say, you know, movies are so much more sophisticated nowadays. We have better lighting techniques, blah, blah, blah. Like,
no movie today looks better than this movie.
Yeah, yeah. That's just not true.
It's not true.
Check it out. See it. I know people listening to this show have probably already seen Sherlock Jr., but encourage your friends. Like, we talk about this a lot, too, that there's, you know, within art history, there's the Renaissance and there's German Expressionism. One is not better than the other, necessarily. It's a matter of preference. So within the history of cinema, there are going to be different styles, different techniques. Like, things are going to change. But one era is not necessarily better than another. And I think they're all are worth considering, all are worth watching. You will find new, interesting things in every single era. This is preaching to the choir here.
No, but it's like, you know, Sherlock Jr. is like the Sistine Chapel, though, of like silent comedy. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just the best.
Yeah.
It's not something that you have to like because it's important.
Yeah.
You'll like it because it's great.
Yeah. Hear, hear. All right, we're on the final reel, but before the credits roll, let's bring it all back around to the TCM Film Fest. Again, starts this Thursday through Sunday, and Kristen and I just want to touch base on some of our plans for the weekend and what listeners can expect, and also just some of the things we're really looking forward to.
Yeah. Well, we talked about Buster Keaton on this show, and they have shown Buster Keaton movies at TCM Fest. Usually they show one silent comedy with live musical accompaniment per festival. And they showed Steamboat Bill Jr. in 2015. And this year they're going to show Speedy, which is a really great... Like, I feel like Speedy is to Harold Lloyd as the cameraman is to Buster Keaton. It's kind of the most sophisticated in terms of filmmaking. There's a lot... There's money in it. It's later in the 20s. I think it's like 1928. But it's really good. Speedy is really good. It's really charming. I'd love to be able to make that if it fits in my schedule because I feel like seeing the silent movies with live musical accompaniment is always really fun, and it's especially fun to hear the waves and the rhythms of the audience laughter because sometimes it peels in really weird ways. Yeah, I remember watching the cameraman at one of the festivals and just some of the sequences would be so blanketed with audience laughter that you couldn't even focus on what was happening in the film because the laughter was moving from like one side of the theater until the other, and it just like kept going like another character in the movie. It was wild. So I definitely recommend if you're going to TCM Fest to, I mean, it's comedy is the whole theme, but I would definitely try to do that silent comedy because that's unlike any other experience, really. And I feel like the other things I'm really excited for, I have to agree with Tiffany in the earlier segment that I'm really excited about the Nitrate. I saw a couple Nitrate prints at the UCLA archive this past year and last year, but I haven't seen any of the ones that they're showing, and I think probably Black Narcissus is my number one just because of the Technicolor. It's gonna look extraordinary. It's not a comedy. It's kind of the opposite of a comedy, but I'm still really looking forward to it.
Yeah. I guess I'm gonna second everything you just said. Black Narcissus, Speedy, live accompaniment. That's tough to beat.
It's good.
Yeah. And just reiterate, they're showing Postcards from the Edge. I'm still really sad.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that maybe I'll find some, I don't know, comfort in,
I think,
in
it's going to be cathartic.
Yeah.
It's the reason that you go to the festival is to watch these movies with other people and to sort of almost like feel the emotions of other people, whether it's laughter or sadness or in that case probably both.
Yeah.
It's going to be great. And I think the good thing about the programming this year that there's so many comedies that depending on what kind of day you're having, you can sort of find a movie that fits your mood.
Yeah.
If you're feeling kind of burnt out and you kind of want to laugh at something stupid and not really worry about too much heaviness, there are options for that. You know, there are options for a more witty screwball comedy. You know, there's absurdism.
I definitely want to check out the two Lubitsches. And I know you've seen a couple of the UCLA prints, the pre-code prints, but I'm really looking forward to Theodore Goes Wild.
Yeah, good movie.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's basically, and as you say, I'm gonna kind of play it by ear and see how I feel. And
yeah, I feel like it's comedy, so I'm not taking myself too seriously.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of gonna go where the day leads, and the good thing about this festival is I know I'm gonna have a good time regardless.
Yeah.
It almost doesn't matter. Like, I have such faith in the programming and where they put certain movies in certain spots, and I have such joy in seeing the same people every year and then also meeting new people who are really excited to be there, that it's always going to be a good time. Yeah. And this is my seventh year, so I'm just like, you know what? Whatever happens, happens. It's going to be great.
Yeah. And that's the way we frame it. Flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, have you ever been to the TCM Film Fest? Come share your experiences with us on our website, flickswise.com. Or you can share some highlights on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. And for highlights and recaps of this year's fest, you should come follow us on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, please, please go to your podcatcher of choice, usually iTunes, subscribe to us, rate us, and leave us a nice comment. It's all we ask. It's all we ever ask. Please, please, please. I don't know how to make myself, like, less pathetic when I do that, but whatever. Just do it. Okay, and so stay tuned, because on our next show, Kristen and I will be back with little mini-sodes, which we'll be releasing throughout the fest. We're going to do updates and recaps and just tell you what's happening.
So, highlights.
Highlights, exactly.
In jokes. Yeah. Sleep deprivation.
Yeah. It could get messy.
Poor nutrition.
Yeah.
Tired feet.
Yeah. So if that all sounds
the festival,
fun.
All the festival highlights.
Yeah. If that all sounds fun, come follow us. Follow along. And, you know, I understand not everyone can make it out to Hollywood in the beginning of April, but it'll feel like you're there.
That's right. We're going to put you inside the festival.
That's right.
Insider information.
So, yeah, and come out if you can. If you're there, come say hi to us.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, I just want to quick another shout out to Tiffany. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And I guess that's it. Kristen, where can people find you on the internet if they want to follow you?
Well, throughout the festival, I'll be tweeting. My handle is @salesonfilm. And then that'll probably be the extent for the festival itself and then the mini-sodes. And then if you're actually here in Hollywood, just come and flag me down.
Yeah.
Or yell my screen name across the lobby. It's happened before. It'll happen again. I swear it's fine.
Yep.
Don't be shy. Just come say hi.
Yep. Oh, I love it. Okay. All right. We'll see you there, guys.